Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the disgraceful behaviour of GOP governors, the Republican House of Representatives, and most of the candidates running for the Republican presidential nomination, not to mention a number of gutless Democrats in the House, all of whom are playing into the hands of Daesh, the Islamic State, by scapegoating and demonizing Muslims, who are the victims of the terrorists responsible for the massacres in Paris. A former jihadi who renounced radical Islam and worked with Canadian intelligence to break up al-Qaeda terrorist plots, Mubin Sheikh, joins us to discuss the sick symbiosis between the Republican right and the Islamic State terrorists, who benefit immeasurably from Islamophobia in the West and the free publicity our media gives them. Then we'll speak with Jeff Biggers, a writer in residence and founder of the Climate Narrative Project at the University of Iowa. We will discuss his article at the New York Times, Iowa's Climate Change Wisdom, and how the adaptation of wind and solar energy and carbon sequestration in soil makes Iowa an important example for the U.S. heading into the upcoming United Nations Conference on Climate Change in Paris. We will also discuss how farmers in America's heartland not only believe global warming is happening, they are playing a key role in climate solutions. Then finally, we'll look into the burn. The Bernie Sanders presidential campaign, with the award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, Will Bunch, who has been on the campaign trail with Bernie Sanders for the last several months, writing a forthcoming ebook for Amazon, The Burn Identity. We will discuss Senator Sanders' recent speech at Georgetown University on democratic socialism and his invocation of President Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights that FDR enunciated in his last State of the Union address in 1944. And joining us now is Mubin Sheikh, who became radicalized with the Taliban in 1995 and was deeply involved in jihadism until the 9/11 attacks, after which he questioned his extremist interpretation of Islam and then spent two more years studying Islam in Syria, where he came to see how his extremism was inconsistent with the teachings of the Quran. After returning to Canada in 2004, he became an undercover counterterrorism operative for the Canadian Security Intelligence Service and one of the few people in the world that's been undercover in al-Qaeda-inspired domestic terrorist groups. Mubin has testified in multiple legal hearings resulting in the prosecution and conviction of 11 aspiring terrorists. His latest book is Undercover Jihadi, Inside the Toronto 18, Al-Qaeda-inspired homegrown terrorism in the West. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mubin Sheikh.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Mubin, your experience is invaluable, but I don't get the impression that somehow in our political discourse here in the United States, particularly in this presidential year where you've got a lot of people running for president, you've just had the majority of American governors close the door on Syrian refugees and some of the political candidates running for president. Ben Carson equating Syrians with rabid dogs, and also Donald Trump suggesting some Nazi-like registration is necessary. From somebody who knows how Daesh, the Islamic State, rattles our chain, don't you feel that we're falling into the trap here, that we're literally playing out of their playbook?
Yeah, that's exactly what we're doing. ISIS might as well give them marching orders, you know, directly by memo, because this is exactly what they're doing. They are reinforcing the ISIS narrative. And, you know, in their manifesto called Black Flags of Rome, they said that they would do this. They would conduct attacks and then bring on or incite retaliation against Muslims, which would then further marginalize and isolate Muslims to then drive them into the waiting hands of ISIS recruitment. Number two, we know that the passport was, and is this according to the French police as well, the passport was staged by the ISIS attackers, specifically to sabotage the Syrian refugee issue, which is exactly what we're doing.
So you deal a lot with U.S. intelligence services, and you also are in a position to understand the effectiveness of how ISIS uses social media. Do you think that here in the United States, since so much of what goes on is on social media, and basically they stage these attacks to get the publicity, which they do get. They get round-the-clock publicity for days on end. And now one guy, just one guy who slipped away from France into Belgium, who may or may not have an explosive vest on, has shut down the entire country of Belgium. He shut the country down for the whole weekend. So there's this incredible asymmetry as a result of their ability to jerk our chain and use our media against us.
You know, it's a schizophrenic approach that we're taking, truly. You know, there's a quote that I will never forget, which says, "Media gives terrorism a longevity it might not otherwise enjoy." And when people ask, you know, how do we counter the message of ISIS, the Muslim community needs to do more. You know, when you have mainstream media outlets effectively acting as the ISIS marketing team, it is impossible to request one community or even all of us. I mean, can we compete with the mainstream media? You know, 24/7, this is why people are in such fear. This is why a country like Belgium can be shut down, because there's constant nonstop coverage and creating fear in the people that we can't even get on with our daily lives. And so it's ironic that on one hand we're saying we need to do something about it, let's not be in fear, but yet what are we doing? We're just reinforcing their message, pumping out their videos, pumping out their accounts, their stories, and over and over, and it's becoming, you know, irreversible. And that's a very, very dangerous situation.
So it would seem to me, Mubin, that there are two things driving this agony in the Middle East and the continuing growth of Daesh, the Islamic State, or ISIS, in spite of the concerted bombing campaign. And now the Russians have joined it, and the French, of course, will also up the ante. And the two factors, to my mind, are, one, that U.S. foreign policy is creating failed states. I mean, after 9/11, we went into a failed state, Afghanistan, and we haven't made it less of a failed state. In fact, we've probably made it more of a failed state after spending trillions in the longest war in U.S. history. And then we made, literally, deliberately, made Iraq a failed state. And we did the same with Libya. And I don't think we can be held responsible necessarily for creating a failed state in Syria, although we didn't do anything about Assad in the early stages when he was slaughtering his own people who were taking to the streets demanding freedom. So here we are creating failed states, which are the breeding grounds for these radical groups. And then on the other side, you have Saudi Arabia that's creating the ideological and religious underpinning of these movements. So do you agree with that thesis?
I do. You know, there is a nexus, an interplay between foreign policy and ideology. For some people, it can be one or the other. For others, it's a mix thereof. So, for example, and it's a very important point to talk about the manner in which Western interventions have been conducted. Being a Canadian, you know, we came up with the concept of responsibility to protect doctrine. I'm not completely against interventions, but I am against only military solutions. It doesn't help. I mean, if you're trying to build a society back up, then you have to invest in it politically, economically, socially, not just bomb the crap out of them. For example, look at, you know, Germany and Japan. Germany and Japan were heavily bombed, but there was also heavy investment after that in the whole of society. This is something that was lacking when it came to the Middle East. Number two, you know, dictatorship. So this idea that, oh, the dictators, you know, keep these violent extremist group down. That's actually not true. Violent dictators create the conditions in which violent extremist groups arise. You know, lack of political participation, corruption, you know, violent persecution and oppression of opposition groups. So that's not a solution either. On the other hand, like you mentioned about Saudi Arabia and, you know, the ideology that comes out of Saudi Arabia, specifically, you know, what came off of the Wahhabi ideology. Now, keep in mind, again, it was the British, right, under Lawrence of Arabia. They were trying to wrest influence away from the Ottoman Caliphate at the time, which was, of course, waning in its influence, post-World War One, especially. And, you know, what the Brits did was they facilitated the rise of these Bedouin tribes to take control over the Hijaz, the Mecca and Medina area. And there was this, you know, relationship between the house of Ibn Saud, who married basically his daughter to Ibn Abdul Wahhab, the progenitor of this Wahhabi sect. So the Ibn Sauds legitimize and validate the Wahhabi sect, and the Wahhabis legitimize and validate Ibn Saud as the rulers of Saudi Arabia. Shortly after, of course, they emerged, what did they do? They went into Iraq, Najaf and Karbala, and started destroying Shia shrines, accusing them of apostasy. And this is exactly what we have word for word in the narratives of ISIS today. So the ideology does grow from Saudi Arabia. There's no getting away from that. And the problem is really it's our addiction to oil at the end of the day. This is why governments after government continue to deal with the Saudi regime, don't really, you know, really come out vociferously against them, because, we're addicts to their product.
Well, there's a really important op-ed that appeared in Saturday's New York Times, electronic version, it's not in the print version, by Kamal Daoud, called Saudi Arabia and ISIS That Has Made It. And let me just quote from this important op-ed, which we'll embed at our website, ianmasters.com. The West's denial regarding Saudi Arabia is striking. It salutes the theocracy as its ally, but pretends not to notice that it is the world's chief ideological sponsor of Islamic culture. The Saudi Wahhabi clergy produces Islamism, which both threatens the country and gives legitimacy to the regime. And let me just go towards the end of the article here. This denial creates the illusion of equilibrium. Jihadism is denounced as the scourge of the century, but no consideration is given to what created it or supports it. This may allow saving face, but not saving lives. Daesh, that's the Islamic State, has a mother, the invasion of Iraq. But it also has a father, Saudi Arabia, and its religious industrial complex. Until that point is understood, battles may be won, but the war will be lost. Jihadists will be killed only to be reborn again in future generations and raised on the same books. The attacks in Paris have exposed this contradiction again, but as happened after 9/11, it risks being erased from our analysis and our consciences. So it's a beautifully written, powerful piece. Do you think it's going to have an effect?
I don't think the article will have any effect. I think, again, with the amount of weapon sales of Western arms manufacturers to the Gulf regimes, there's a lot of money to be made off of war. This is just one reason why we will be caught up in this cycle of treating symptoms and not getting to the root causes.
So if you were consulting with the White House or whoever has authority here, and obviously the president's handling of the situation in the Middle East is always being criticized all the time, and particularly now where he's really trying to do his best to undo the damage being done by Republican governors and Republican presidential candidates, not to mention the House of Representatives, who shut the door on Syrian refugees, as you've pointed out, playing right into Daesh's hands. The president, in a visit to Malaysia, went out of his way to speak with some young Muslim school kids to illustrate the point that your whole sort of life journey is also about. So how do you get the U.S. savvy about social media? One of the things that has occurred to me and some friends of mine who work in at the Annenberg School, for example, looking at the impact of social media, that if you could cut ISIS or Daesh off from Twitter and YouTube, etc., wouldn't that have a big effect?
Yeah, I mean, it would have had a huge effect had this been done, 2 years ago. When I got online, really from 2012, after the Arab Spring, of course, the so-called Arab Spring, which was, of course, squashed by Sisi's coup, I saw these accounts proliferate. I saw the messaging continue. I saw with my own eyes the recruitment happening. I stepped in where I could, dissuading some from joining ISIS. I will say it openly, Twitter enabled ISIS. And they were told repeatedly that, listen, you're like, but they wanted to maintain, no, freedom of expression, freedom of speech. And I find it abhorrent that we extend freedom of speech to terrorist organizations whose end goal is to end all our rights. And that's not hyperbole, that's reality. They publish documents to this effect. For example, in Dabiq magazine, they said that, you know, we don't want a truce. We will continue to fight the non-believers because of their unbelief. Okay, so whether you bomb them or you withdraw from them, it doesn't matter. The fact that you are not what they believe, they will continue to fight you. So, you know, there's a number of facilitators, and social networks were definitely one of them, Twitter in particular. But then, you know, it was too late. Once they started blocking some accounts, by then the narrative had set, you know, the mindset had set. And for a lot of young people seeking glory, seeking adventure, heroism, the myth was made, and now it's going to be too late. Now is why we're talking about bombings, and of course, bombings by themselves aren't going to do anything. Groups like ISIS will hide among civilian populations. You can't bomb civilian populations. I mean, that makes it worse, right? That also feeds into their narrative, and I mean, they invite strikes into civilian areas just so they can then say, "See, they're here to kill civilians." And so, again, we're playing into that. Really, if I can just kind of make this point, the only way is for Muslim armies, Muslim nations, to take the lead to effectively conduct house-to-house searches in ISIS-held areas. That really is the only way you're going to do it. Counter-messaging online is not going to get rid of, you know, there are 25,000 at least foreign fighters, not Westerners. There are only 5,000 Western foreign fighters. Okay, out of countries of tens of millions of Muslims, 5,000 have decided to up and go. That doesn't count, of course, those that are willing acolytes and supporters of ISIS in the home countries. That's still a small number when you're looking at the, you know, 20,000 plus Arabs who are going from either North Africa or wherever else. Social networking is just a dent. It will only make a small scratch on the surface. The real way to deal with ISIS is going to be on the ground.
Well, at least Anonymous, the sort of anonymous hacktivist group, did take out 3,800 of ISIS's or Daesh's Twitter accounts in just one day. But the real issue, as far as I understand, Mubin Sheikh, is that the Silicon Valley powers like Google that own YouTube have managed to put a sort of what they call a safe harbor provision, which basically says we're just conduits. We don't take any responsibility for what crosses through our communications channels, and therefore we're sort of like the piano player in the whorehouse, you know. But the truth of the matter is they do intervene. There is no pornography on YouTube. There is no pornography on Twitter. So they're talking out of both sides of their mouths, the big Silicon Valley billionaires.
Absolutely. I mean, wasn't their motto supposed to be do no harm, Google? And that's exactly what they're doing. And it's highly, highly irresponsible for these organizations. Listen, when we talk about free speech, we're talking about a context in which you have opposing political viewpoints. We're talking about extending such rights to those who have a constructive approach to society. That's the context of free speech. When now we start giving these rights to individuals who literally want to get rid of your rights completely, then we've overstepped. We've lost the point of free speech. And like you mentioned, you know, there's no child pornography on YouTube or on Twitter or on Google, but yet, you know, you have terrorist propaganda, I mean, the propaganda side is a whole other issue. We can talk about, you know, okay, I mean, some, the grievance narratives, the ideology, that needs to be debated. That needs to be, you know, confronted and countered publicly. But when you're encouraging recruitment, when you're encouraging, you know, spreading of videos of people getting their heads sawed off, we've gone far beyond the pale now. And this is, we're reaping the consequences of it. Now we're asking ourselves, what can we do to counter their messaging? And yet, the very same mediums that claim to now help us stop this recruitment, they've facilitated the rise of it.
Well, Mubin Sheikh, I very much appreciate your time here today and being able to get your direct experience, unique as it is, in talking about this important issue.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with the Mubin Sheikh, who became radicalized with the Taliban in 1995 and was deeply involved in jihadism until the 9/11 attacks, after which he questioned his extremist interpretation of Islam. He then spent two more years studying Islam in Syria, where he came to see how his extremism was inconsistent with the teaching of the Quran. And after returning to Canada in 2004, he became an undercover counterterrorism operative for the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, one of the few people in the world to have been undercover in Al-Qaeda-inspired domestic terrorist groups. Mubin has testified in multiple legal hearings, resulting in the prosecution and conviction of 11 aspiring terrorists. His latest book is Undercover Jihadi, Inside the Toronto 18, Al-Qaeda-inspired homegrown terrorism in the West. And our next guest, unfortunately, had an emergency, had to take his wife to the hospital. But we were back in a moment talking about the future, whether the future of the Democratic Party belongs to Bernie Sanders. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is John Judas, who's a senior editor at The New Republic, an active
member. No.
Okay, what are you? Sorry.
I haven't been at The New Republic for a year. We all quit December of last year.
Oh, that's right. You walked out when the young billionaire took over, right? So how do I introduce you then?
I'm a senior writer at National Journal.
Okay, National Journal. All right. But you were an active member of SDS and the left in the 60s. You taught philosophy at Berkeley and at San Francisco Art Institute. And your books include A Paradox of American Democracy, Elite Special Interests and the Betrayal of Public Trust, William F. Buckley, Patron Saint of the Conservatives and Grand Illusion, Critics and Champions of the American Century. And your latest article at the National Journal is The Burn Supremacy. Does the future of the Democratic Party belong to Sanders? Welcome to Background Briefing, John Judas.
Thank you.
And Bernie Sanders made a significant speech at Georgetown University on democratic socialism, where he also invoked FDR's second Bill of Rights speech in his final address to the State of the Union address in 1944. What was your response to Bernie Sanders' recent speech?
Oh, you know, I thought it was a fine speech, but I think that he, like I, was a socialist from the 1960s, and he had, as I did, a much different interpretation of what socialism meant then. And I think that Bernie, since the 1990s, since he became a congressman, as he himself says, is much more accurately portrayed as an American progressive. He doesn't believe anymore in public ownership and control of the means of production of the great industries and banks of the country. What instead he believes is very stiff, strict regulation of those industries on behalf of the public interest. And that's a different politics. And I think what he was doing at Georgetown was really trying to say that he doesn't think of socialism the way he used to and the way that some people still say, think of it. Donald Trump called him a communist, for instance. He's never been that. But again, I think he was trying to put to rest any kind of misunderstanding of what his views really are. And the effect of that was to kind of redefine down democratic socialism in America as a form of left liberalism, progressivism. And I don't see that as a bad thing. I think that the result is that he is presenting a politics that's viable and possible and credible for the Democratic Party and, eventually, I hope, for the country itself.
Well, early in the campaign, of course, he was asked whether he believes in capitalism, and he said, no, I'm a democratic socialist. And a lot of pundits thought that was a massive mistake on his part. Because of America's aversion to socialism, clearly, even though arguably FDR and that whole late period of the New Deal going through World War II, America had a form of democratic socialism, perhaps even from 1947 to 1977 in the European model. But since Reagan, it's all but been certainly been under attack. Do you think that he could have made this Georgetown speech a little earlier?
Oh, sure. But, it's for people like you and me, and it's for the, general, the pundits and stuff like that. That's not what he's basing his campaign on. It would have been fine, but that's not the heart of his campaign.
So what can be done, though, to particularly in the red states for Bernie Sanders to have traction? Because, in my conversations with him, he's pointed out, and it's absolutely clear, I think, that everything that he says, the people in these red states who vote Republican would agree with him. But he's already been labeled as, an agent of the devil in terms of the S word.
Well, again, I don't know whether that's his problem. He's running in the Democratic primary. So are you asking whether in a general election he could win Alabama or something like that? Just tell me.
Well, that was the idea that, it goes back to Howard Dean's 50-state strategy, whether you just, basically write off the red states. And in my conversations with Bernie, he understands that that if only he could reach the people in the country that liberals always talk about, that they vote against their own interests. He basically says their interests and mine are the same. They just haven't had access to what I'm saying.
I don't think that's probably true. But, we're not going to test it this year in any case, because I don't think he's going to get that far. But if you look at his base, his political base, who comes to the rallies, who are his most enthusiastic supporters, and who, on the basis of the polling is, they have five sample of 500 and stuff, so it's hard to say. He's drawing a lot of his support from students and people who went to college or graduate student and who are now professionals of one sort or another. Those are the kind of people that I've seen at his rallies. They predominate. So, those same people in Alabama and Mississippi might vote for him too, but they're not. They don't make up as much of the electorate as they do in New Jersey, or let's say a state like North Carolina or Virginia, which are more high tech. So, no, realistically, I don't think that. I think that there is a kind of old time romanticism about Bernie that he has, and that's a lot of people on the left have, that there's something called the working man or working people, and they're just waiting to hear the message. But the America is really different now. It's not the same kind of country. About a quarter of the electorate are these people that the census calls professionals. They produce sophisticated services, ideas, things like that. So it's not a, you know, he's really, he's oddly talking to a different group. The lower middle class, the people who might not have finished college or went to, let's say, a state school, a lot of them are supporting Trump. That's his base. So it's an odd kind of mix. But I don't want you to get, you stop me if it's too historical. But if you look at the history of the left itself, going back to the 19th century. Its political base has always been pretty much among the higher rather than the lower levels of the working class, among the aristocracy of labor, it used to be called, even before that, among the small proprietors, not the poor. So it's not unusual, but it's contrary to the kind of image, and I think it runs against Sanders saying that, well, if, you know, the people of Alabama or West Virginia or Kentucky could hear my message, then they'd all vote for me. I don't know if that's true. I think his politics are viable, but to a very similar constituency that Hillary Clinton is also appealing to.
Well, I think it's pretty clear that from the polls and from some momentum and trajectory that she's got the nomination pretty much. But he's still, at least in terms of the speech at Georgetown and his campaign itself, I think is changing the discourse, at least taking the stigma off the S word. But my sense is that if you could explain social democracy in the European context the way that he has tried by mentioning Denmark, which, of course, all the pundits sort of laughed about, you know, we're not Denmark, we're a hugely different country. The concept of, as far as I can see it, and having lived in these countries, and even Canada next door is another example, is that the taxpayers in social democracy pay their taxes and get government services. Here, we pay our taxes and don't get government services, except for Social Security, Medicare, which the Republicans are trying to undermine constantly. So it's not an argument about big government. It's an argument about better government, isn't it?
Well, I think there is a problem with identifying democratic socialism with Denmark or Sweden, because of what you mentioned, both centralized government and high taxes, and I don't think Americans are ready to support that.
High taxes in exchange for government services.
You know, that appeal has not worked. Just let me say, there's just not enough support for it, and it's part of our, you know, it's part of America's history. The only times when people have supported really high tax rates are during wars. You know, then you go up to 90% or something on the marginal tax rates, but then steady disintegration until you get finally to Reagan and all that stuff, you know, where it's down to, 28% on the very rich. So, we have an anti-tax, anti-government heritage, and we have to somehow work out an idea of a progressive or liberal or whatever you want to call it, democratic socialism, if you like, politics that accords with that, that doesn't simply run into the face of that. One thing is regulation rather than nationalization. That's an important. There has to be a way of doing the healthcare system, and some other countries in Europe do it without getting into the problem of that Bernie Sanders would get into if he were to win the nomination of how you're saying that we have to spend $15 trillion. That's the figure. In 10 years on the health care, you know, that's going to mean higher taxes, et cetera, et cetera. And then that's the end of his candidacy. So there has to, again, I think that this is something that's going to have to be resolved in the next 4 or 8 years, not in this election. And he's raising the right question, especially about the campaign finance stuff and America becoming an oligarchy, and I think that people are responding to it. And oddly, that is a place where Trump and he are drawing from the same kind of complaint about America. Trump says he self-financed. Bernie Sanders says it's all small donors. When I interviewed people, I was struck because I did a Trump article before this. If you took like the first three sentences they would say about Sanders, they were the same first three sentences that they'd say about, you know, you get the Trump supporters. He's not self-interested. He's for the country and not himself. He's not going to take money from billionaires, et cetera, et cetera. I think he's raising very important issues. It's just that it's going to take a while to figure them, to frame them in a way that you could win a majority in this country.
So in terms of the, you mentioned that your piece on Trump, just to touch on that, you're arguing that the Trump phenomenon is not about his personality, but largely about his ideological position. So give us encapsulate that, if you will.
Well, it's about his personality in the sense of the take charge guy, the larger than life person. Somebody who there is that appeal. There's the man on horseback kind of appeal that Trump has. There's no doubt about that. But he's also ringing a lot of bells. The immigration stuff is very important. Attacking illegal immigration. That again is a big issue with the kind of used to be called Reagan Democrats. There are people There's a book that I keep referring to in my articles by Donald Warren that he wrote about the Middle American radicals. He was trying to understand George Wallace in 1968-72. And these were people at the time who had graduated from high school and had gone no further, but were middle class. And they were a lot of Wallace's base. And that those people have moved up. Now they might have gone to college. They might have degrees. But that's the, again, primarily white. That's a lot of the Perot voters. That was the Buchanan voters, and now they've gone to Trump. And it's an important group in America. I think it's limited. I don't think that Trump is a majority candidate. I think if he wins the nomination, which is now possible, I didn't think so 6 months ago. I think he'd have a lot of trouble beating a Democrat, beating Hillary Clinton, because he would lose. I would compare it to California in 94. Now, Pete Wilson won that election, but that was the year of Proposition. Which was it in California? The
anti 186, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, after that, California was solidly Democratic. And before that, it was a fight each election. And I think that it wouldn't be as dramatic nationally, but I think that that a Trump candidacy would push America in a similar direction that California went after 94. So I don't think he's I don't think he's viable as a president, but God knows, I might be wrong, but he does have a very solid vote within the Republican Party. He has a solid base, and there are again certain odd similarities between that base. You could say lower middle class, upper middle class, complaint about America and the direction it's gone, and the corruption in politics, the gridlock in Washington. All these things are contributing on the one hand to the Trump, on the other hand to Sanders.
Well, just returning to Bernie Sanders, and you mentioned his campaign speeches and appearances and in debates, mentioning the oligarchy and basically framing the challenge, I think, which is a real one. Are we a democracy or have we become an oligarchy? And that sort of resonates because I think it's largely true, isn't it? I mean, we may not be able to have a social democracy in this country in the European style because of the reasons that you mentioned, the aversion to taxes. Surely it's pretty clear that instead of a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, we have a government of the powerful oligarchs and huge corporate interests by them and for them. And, isn't that abundantly clear? And it seems to be clear.
Well, that is to the extent that it was not true before, it's certainly been made true by the Supreme Court rulings on campaign finance. And people, that's broadly understood now, and it's especially understood by the Democratic electorate. All you have to do is mention the Koch brothers, and people go berserk. And you know, I'm not denying that they're Democrat billionaires and whatever who do the same thing. But it is, again, it's a the rich have an inordinate amount of influence, even compared to what it was before, and that's becoming a problem for people.
Well, John Judas, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Sure. Bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with John Judas, who is a senior writer at the National Journal. He was an active member of SDS and the left of the 60s. He taught philosophy at Berkeley and at San Francisco Art Institute. And his books include The Paradox of American Democracy, Elite Special Interests and the Betrayal of Public Trust, William F. Buckley, Patron Saint of the Conservatives, and Grand Illusion, Critics and Champions of the American Century. His latest article at the National Journal is The Byrne Supremacy. Does the future of the Democratic Party belong to Sanders? We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the author of a new ebook forthcoming from Amazon, The Byrne Identity.
It's the money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Will Bunch, an award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. He blogs at Attitude, that's attytwood.com. His books include Tear Down This Myth, The Right-Wing Distortion of the Reagan Legacy, and The Backlash, Right-Wing Radicals, High-Def Hucksters, and the Paranoid Politics in the Age of Obama. He has been on the campaign trail with Bernie Sanders for the last several months, and his new ebook from Amazon forthcoming is The Byrne Identity. Welcome to Background Briefing, Will Bunch.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me back on again. It's great that you can go from the Byrne supremacy to the Byrne identity in one show.
So. It's true. Well, we had to be nimble on our feet here because our second guest suddenly had to go to the emergency room.
Well, that's great.
So we're continuing. We're on a flow here. The Byrne is getting to both of us. Let me start with the question I asked John Judas about the speech at Georgetown. What did you make of Bernie Sanders' speech on democratic socialism?
I think it's what people who've been following his campaign expected it to be, which was a great explainer, you know, and a full-throated defense of what exactly he means when he talks about socialism. We've been on quite a journey in this country politically. I mean, just think about 8 years ago when Barack Obama was coming onto the scene, and that was how conservatives planned to destroy his candidacy, right? It was by calling him a socialist. You know, that was like the worst slur you could put on somebody, that if people, you know, associated Barack Obama as being a socialist, that would destroy his campaign or destroy his presidency once he got elected. Now here we are 8 years later, and we have somebody who's running for president who describes himself as a democratic socialist and who's been a socialist, was involved back in the 1960s with the Young Socialist People's League, the YPSLs, and he's doing very well. In fact, he just gained a little bit in the latest polls, and he's getting at least 35% of the Democratic primary vote, and he hasn't had a chance to even introduce himself to all of the voters yet. So I think it marks a kind of an historic moment for how we look at ideology in this country. And I think, you know, what he was trying to do in that speech really was just to explain to people, when he talks about democratic socialism, he's not talking about the state expropriating private businesses, as you might see maybe in a more extreme form of socialism. He's looking at European countries such as Scandinavia that have a strong safety net, encourage voter participation and have high tax rates on the wealthy and a more fair distribution of wealth. He doesn't want to nationalize Amazon or Microsoft or anything like that. I think the speech was a great way to explain that. It's kind of a shame that he delivered it in a week when everybody was so obsessed with terrorism and the events over in Paris. I don't know if it really got the attention that it fully deserved, but I do think it's something that gives him a great base on going forward to explain just what exactly he stands for as a presidential candidate.
Well, unfortunately, I think in many ways he wrong-footed himself, because he was asked early in the campaign about whether he's a capitalist or believes in capitalism. Obviously, they were trying to smoke him out on being a socialist. And frankly, I think the correct answer would be, capitalism is not an ideology. It's a fact. It's not that I don't believe in it. I'm not a capitalist. I'm not a banker. I'm a public servant. I'm a U.S. senator. Unlike my colleagues, I don't take money from the capitalists in this campaign in particular. So, do you think he should have framed his definition of who he is and what he stands for earlier?
I think so, because I think he announced his candidacy back in May, and it really caught fire. I think even he and the people around him were surprised at the initial reaction he got from the liberal base of the Democratic Party. So you see these turnouts like in Los Angeles where you are, where 28,000 people showed up. That they had people waiting outside the arena when he spoke, and I think. I don't know if they expected that strong a reaction, and I think looking back, I think he would have the speech that he delivered this week at Georgetown, I think he would have delivered earlier in the campaign to try and get his message out. I do think he did a good job, in reporting my new ebook for Amazon, The Burn Identity. One of the places I spent some time was Las Vegas, where they had a big debate back in October, and I thought that was really kind of his introduction to a lot of voters, and he was asked a lot of questions about what he believes about capitalism and socialism, and I thought he explained it very well in that setting. Even though Anderson Cooper, the moderator, I was kind of surprised the extent of modern day red baiting really that went on, where he was asked about his supposed honeymoon in the Soviet Union, which was really a trade mission that happened to be right after he got married, so he did a 2-for-1, and now all of a sudden he's this like red diaper baby or something who went on this. Who took his honeymoon in Soviet Russia. So, mm-hmm. He's been on the defensive somewhat, but I really haven't seen any evidence that it's hurt him, at least in the Democratic primaries. I haven't seen evidence that people are turning away from him because of the socialist label. And in fact, what's interesting is if you look at the polls where they do head-to-head matchups of either Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton against the likely Republican nominees, in some of those polls, Bernie Sanders does as well as Hillary, and in some of them, I've seen he's actually done better than Hillary Clinton against the Republicans. So, I don't think that's what's hurting him. I mean, I think he's struggling to get better known. I think he's not very well known in, the African American, the Latino, some of the communities that are really critical to winning in the Democratic primaries, and I think that's his bigger struggle than socialism at this point.
Well, he definitely. I thought, in terms of their speech at Georgetown, enunciating FDR's second Bill of Rights, which FDR delivered in his last State of the Union address in 1944, when you that can't be repeated enough. I mean, I wish that everybody in America actually heard FDR's final address and what he was saying. We should have guaranteed health care, housing. Education, which is what the rest of the advanced democracies have,
And earlier, a few years earlier, FDR had also spoken of the four freedoms, and that included, the economic freedom, basically, the freedom to live a life of economic security, which we definitely do not have in this country at this time. When we're still struggling to get everybody on health insurance. you know, when people, you know, who want to get ahead in the job world are having to go $50,000, $60,000, $100,000 in debt with student loans. I mean, that's definitely not, you know, the freedom from economic want that FDR talked about. So I think he's absolutely right. You know, I mean, one thing. I mean, although I think the FDR Association isn't new for him, but I do think maybe there was something else going on there, and that I think he wanted to play up the connection after the mainstream media started focusing so heavily on the Paris attacks, because, you know, FDR, you know, started out to rescue the country economically and ended up being a great wartime leader of this country. And I think there was a subtle underlying message to that speech that, you know, you can be for the working class, you know, and you can be for poor people in this country, and you can still be a strong leader on the international scene because look at FDR. So I think there was a lot of intelligence in that aspect of it, and I don't know how much people picked up on that, but I certainly picked up on it. Mm. And he did devote part of his speech to foreign policy as well. So
sure. Well, I think it's perfectly possible to be an idealist on domestic politics and a realist on foreign policy, even though a lot of people on the far left, you know, reflexively blame America for everything, and unless you go along with their narrative, you're not a warmonger, you know.
Yeah, well, he's, you know, I mean, you know, in reporting the Byrne identity, you know, one thing I really looked at closely is how much has he really stayed true to his ideals over this long period of 50, 60 years, and where has he been able to, you know, make adjustments to maybe make himself a little bit more electable and maybe a little bit more palatable to a broader stretchy electorate. And I think foreign policy is one area where, you know, I mean, like a lot of people coming out of the 1960s campus movements, you know, he started out very reflexive against U.S. military involvement, and he still opposes most military involvement, but he did support, you know, the initial war in Afghanistan in 2001, and, you know, he said that he would even, you know, continue the drone program under certain conditions, I believe. So he absolutely is trying to convey that. But, you know, I mean, the other thing about FDR is, I mean, he's a child of the New Deal himself. He was born in Brooklyn in 1939, and FDR's reforms of the New Deal gave his family, you know, his dad was a Jewish immigrant from Poland who came over here in 1921. Kind of a struggling paint salesman, but they always had that safety net, you know, that FDR had created during the New Deal, and I think that was one of the factors that influenced him, and also his older brother Larry Sanders, who's a politician in England and was a big influence on his younger brother, were both, you know, heavily influenced by what happened in the New Deal. So it's not surprising that he would go that route.
So what's the kind of feeling on the campaign trail with Bernie Sanders? What's the sense of him? Because, you know, in that that forum he did with Rachel Maddow, I thought his humanity came across. You know, talking about his grandchildren, I thought he just won that hands down, because you got a taste of the man himself, you know, as opposed to this.
Well, it's interesting because you know, again, talking about evolution, the first time I saw him in person, when I started working on this back in early September, he was still, at least in that regard, I don't know if stiff's the right word, but, you know, he's always had a very strong reluctance to talk about himself personally. And, you know, in 2015, in this age of personal kind of confessional politics, that kind of makes him an outlier. He really believes in getting up there for 50 minutes and traveling around the country, giving essentially the same speech everywhere he goes. Basically, this is what I think's wrong with America, and this is what I think we need to do to fix it. And that's the same speech he delivers night after night. But he has also changed somewhat over the course of just a few months. And I think he's gotten much better. He understands, you know, how much voters need in terms of getting to be comfortable with you personally, and he's gotten much better about that. You know, as I traveled around the country, you know, from Virginia to Massachusetts to Las Vegas, you know, I try to spend a lot of time among his supporters. And to me, this book that I wrote, The Byrne Identity, is almost as much about them as it is about him, because, you know, there really is this huge audience of people out there. It's kind of a mix. I mean, certainly there's a traditional liberal element that goes way back, and of course some of the people like Bernie himself go all the way back to the 60s and their kind of commitment to liberal causes. But there's also a lot of middle class people who are just consumed with anxiety of, you know, how am I going to pay for college? Or, you know, people I met whose, you know, kid was still living in the basement when he was 25 because he couldn't pay off his student loan. Or how am I going to care for my ailing husband at home? You know, I met a lot of folks who had never been politically active, you know, never been involved in campaigns, or in a couple of cases, even people who'd been Republicans, you know, who kind of got put off by the rightward drift of the party and the fact that they felt the Republican Party was doing nothing for the middle class. So, I mean, to me, the most striking thing from the campaign trail wasn't even so much Bernie, although he is striking certainly in his own way, but the people, you know, that just the desire of the people for some new kind of leadership, and they really crave authenticity. You know, they're sick of sound bites. They're sick of politicians who are kind of managed by focus group, you know, who take their orders from high price consultants. The idea of this guy in his rumpled suit getting up there with no notes for 50 minutes and talking, they love it, you know. You know, there's no props. He just gets up there on a bare stage and a small lectern and maybe a page or two of notes, and he delivers this overview of, you know, Wall Street and greed and college tuition and healthcare and social and criminal justice. There's a real hankering for that. And also the other thing is, there's a real hankering to get money out of politics. I mean, the fact that he doesn't have a super PAC, the fact that he doesn't take any donations larger than the federal, you know, personal maximum of $2,700. It used to be that was kind of inside baseball, that average voters didn't really want to hear about or care about campaign finance. But over time, sure, the idea that our political system has been bought and paid for, right, is just seeped into the public consciousness, and now voters really care about this issue a lot.
Well, Wibunch, I'm looking forward to talking to you when your book comes out, The Byrne Identity, the new ebook from Amazon, and I thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks a lot, Ian. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Will Bunch, who's an award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. He blogs at Attitude, that's attytwood.com. His books include Tear Down This Myth, The Right-Wing Distortion of the Reagan Legacy, and The Backlash, Right-Wing Radicals, High-Def Hucksters, and Paranoid Politics in the Age of Obama. He's been on the campaign trail with Bernie Sanders for the last several months, and his new ebook from Amazon is The Byrne Identity. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.